Welcome to Interviews for Resistance. We are now several months into the Trump administration, and activists have scored some important victories in those months. Yet there's always more to be done, and for many people, the question of where to focus and how to help remains. In this series, we talk with organizers, agitators, and educators, not only about how to resist, but how to build a better world. I'm Sarah Jaffe, your host.
My name's Jennifer Hill, and I am with Advocacy Partners Team and the Miami Worker Center.
All right. And so let's just start off with you're in Miami dealing with the aftermath of the storm, and you work with undocumented workers, low-income workers in Miami in general. So I guess start off by just telling us what the scene is in Miami. What are the issues you guys are dealing with right now?
Well, there are a lot of issues because Miami is a very low-income community and a community with with its share of problems and with a kind of patchwork of different interests and different groups that are involved. So we work primarily with low-income women of color who are trying to make changes in their lives and trying to make changes in policy in a broad agenda of issue areas that we call the FEM agenda. Women and femmes of color. And we are working in areas of housing and healthcare and labor and a little bit in education.
Right. And so on all of those fronts, I'm sure there's a lot happening right now.
There's always a lot happening.
Yeah. So let's start off with, I guess you were, before I turned the recorder on, we're talking a bit about what happens to the workers who get involved in doing recovery work and the situation that you're seeing now several weeks after the storm, and how that's affecting the workers that you work with.
Sure. It's interesting when you have something like a hurricane or another natural disaster, because you have the immediate impacts and then you have the impacts that kind of start to roll out a few weeks down the road. So now that we're a few weeks down the road, we're seeing the second wave of impacts, and those tend to have to do with evictions and or employment issues that occur in large part because of the disruptions of employment and income during the actual hurricane. So a lot of times we have members who are saying, for example, that they had to leave their apartment after the storm because it was uninhabitable or repairs needed to be made, and their landlords told them, go find someplace else to live. And they have to go find someplace else to live, and that's expensive in some ways. There are additional expenses, but the rent is not cut off. They still have to pay rent. So they're paying rent, and they're paying the additional housing or transportation or food costs that come from staying with friends or trying to eat out more often because they don't have access to a kitchen or whatever it might be. And because of that, they cannot make their rent. And because they can't make their rent, they're now facing eviction. Or perhaps they suffered short-term unemployment during the hurricane, so they didn't have their complete income, plus they had some additional expenses, and now they're trying to pay their rent, and they can't, and they're getting an eviction notice, or they're getting threats of eviction, which adds tremendously to stress and to financial challenges.
And in terms of when we're talking about the work of disaster recovery, what are you seeing on the ground in terms of that, how is that affecting the people in your community?
Well, there's a lot there. The work of disaster recovery probably varies a lot according to how efficient the government agencies are that are delivering disaster relief. And, you know, we have a lot of great public servants in South Florida who did great work and are trying to do great work. We also have some obstacles to overcome, and one of those has been, I should say that many families in South Florida include both documented and undocumented members, and certainly many neighborhoods, apartments, communities have a mix of people who are eligible for formal disaster relief and ineligible for disaster relief. And so for the members that we have seen, the biggest challenge in disaster relief for those who are eligible or dependent on someone who's eligible for relief have been in programs that are administered by the state, the disaster food relief and the disaster unemployment relief. Both programs have had huge problems, and those problems have not been quickly worked out. We have asked for extensions of the state. Even when extensions have been granted, the programs are still full of problems. We had thousands of people waiting in line for disaster SNAP. We've had people who had to come in three or four times to continuously try to apply for disaster unemployment. And so those problems are hard because it's stressful and time-consuming and frustrating. And then the folks for folks who are not necessarily eligible for those for one reason or another, there are problems that sort of trickle out because they also have, in addition to the sort of short-term food, the short-term expense problems, the income problems and the expense problems, there's also a lot of fear that if they have to ask for time off or they have to look for help or they have to try to ask employers or landlords or anyone else to make repairs when they don't want to make repairs or to put them back to work when they don't want to put them back to work, they face the problem of potential retaliation. And, you know, threats to report them to ICE, threats of arrest or deportation, threats to make false allegations of theft, something like that. Yeah. So it exacerbates the fear that's already there, and the fear is already there for really good reasons.
Yeah. Yeah, there were reports around when around the time the storm was actually hitting that, you know, people were going to be checking for papers at emergency shelters, that there were, you know, police crackdowns, running warrants at shelters, things like that. So, you know, we see the security response a lot in response to disasters.
Yes, and any kind of increase in the policing presence in low-income communities can increase fears of immigration consequence, but it's even worse now because Miami-Dade has eliminated its prior policy of not cooperating with ICE detainers, not sharing information, all information with immigration officials. And now that those policies are not in place, there's more of a kind of a Wild West feel, this idea that different police officers can decide, have much more discretion to decide when and how to call in ICE officials, and that ICE is less constrained or less worried about what they're doing, and so they could be more aggressive. So there's always fear, and it's worse now, and the reasons that people are fearful are quite valid.
Right. And, you know, how does that affect people's just trust, I guess, in the systems that are set up to provide relief?
Oh, it's tremendously damaging to trust. I've never seen as much sort of palpable fear, not only of direct engagement, but fear of dealing with the police, fear of going into government buildings in case there's some kind of ID check, fear of applying for benefits for which people are eligible, because of how the information could be used. It's sort of almost any kind of interaction with the official world creates a lot of doubts and fear.
And so tell us a little bit about the organizing that you're doing in the wake of the storm, how this has affected things you were previously working on, stuff like that.
For example, we always do a lot of housing advocacy, and in the wake of the storm, there were some residents of a building, of a public housing community, actually two public housing communities, well, put out on the street. Basically, in the storm, the folks were evacuated, and then when they came back to re-enter their buildings had been closed down as uninhabitable, and they weren't allowed to get back in to get medicine or clothing, or and they didn't know where they were supposed to live, and they were given to stay in a hotel, but they didn't want to leave, so folks started camping out in the parking lot of the building and trying to get city officials and county officials and federal officials to let them back into their building. The building had been slated for repairs before the hurricane, but there was a sense that the hurricane was opportunistically used to try to push folks out for the whole duration of the repairs, and that it maybe was going to be insecure even after that, when folks would get back in or whether folks would get back in. So what we did a lot of work with that those individuals to try to help them get access to their belongings, but also to try to work with legal services officials and city officials to help make sure that this was not a mechanism for displacement. Because one of the things that we saw in every area of work in which we're active is that the short-term needs and the short-term kind of crisis of the storm can be used opportunistically to move forward longer-term agendas of displacement or impoverishment or, you know, reducing people's access to the basic necessities of life, like jobs and food and education and healthcare and housing. And so we've worked on that in housing, and we've really sort of increased our awareness of the uses of threats of retaliation in an employment context. Always we see workers who are threatened with arrest or deportation if they try to complain about workplace conditions, or if they try to make change at work and try to, if they're injured, if they have to file a worker comp claim, if their wages aren't fully paid. But in the wake of the storm, we are much more aware of how quickly those sorts of threats can be triggered, and how sort of silently retaliation can happen. And so we're trying to change some of our policy goals to make it easier for people who are involved in some kind of workplace dispute, which is a civil dispute, to have access to the sorts of certifications or investigations that would allow them to seek immigration relief if they're victims of actual crime, because people are afraid to go to the police. There's an increase in retaliation or an intensification of retaliatory threats, but people are afraid to go to law enforcement. So we're trying to expand the ability of agencies that look into other sorts of violations, like human rights violations or workplace violations, to also help with complaints about retaliation based on immigration status or threats based on immigration status, because this stuff is never going to get handled because people are going to stay afraid to go to law enforcement. They're kind of caught between a rock and a hard place. If they go to law enforcement, maybe law enforcement is going to arrest them, or maybe they're going to dismiss their complaints and say that's just a civil dispute. If they go to the civilian, you know, the civil processes like the wage theft ordinance process, they get told, well, you have a wage theft claim, but I don't know, you know, I can't do anything about the fact that your employer has threatened to report you to ICE if you go forward with this claim. So what do? They can't go either place. So for us, this has been a moment where we really have tried to think about how do we start doing a better job of putting in place mechanisms that will allow people to reduce the potency of these immigration-related threats, because it's so prevalent. And it can be done in a house. People, landlords use these threats. Boyfriends or intimate partners use these threats. Employers use these threats. And we have to get better strategies for reducing the incredible effectiveness of these threats.
That's the point you made, particularly about like intimate partner abuse. I mean, we're in this moment where the entire world seems to be talking about sexual harassment and sexual violence all of a sudden. So I wonder if you could talk about that in relation to what happens after a disaster and what happens to people who aren't, you know, as famous as some of the people who've gotten attention lately.
Yes. Well, there are pretty clear statistics that rates of intimate partner violence go up in the wake of disasters. We had some folks who had to go through that who are members. And our recent experience has been pretty bad. One member was facing what we consider to be extortion, a demand for payment from an ex-partner. If she didn't pay him money, then he was going to report her or others in her family and among her friends to immigration. And she did call the police. One of our organizers and activists took her into her home, called the police. The police came to take a report, and And the police were absolutely unsympathetic and said that she was, it was not extortion. There was no crime that took place because the perpetrator was simply expressing that his true belief that he could call ICE and report her. And not only that, but they also then turned to the woman who was a U.S. citizen who was hosting her and said, and you could be prosecuted for harboring someone who's undocumented. So instead of treating the victim like the victim and acting in a way that allowed the victim to seek help and feel safe seeking help, they basically said, not only are you unsafe in your life and going to get no help from us, but even in this place of harbor where you have come to stay with a friend and be safe from the perpetrator, you need to go find another place because you're not safe here and neither is she. We might just come back and, you know, arrest her for harboring an undocumented immigrant, even though she was the one who was being threatened and extorted by a domestic partner who was trying to keep her in fear and keep control over her. So our experience has been that it's going to take a lot more advocacy because we have two completely entrenched problems, the problems of intimate partner violence and the problems of sort of anti-immigrant, three problems, anti-immigrant attitudes and then the sort of policing control response of in communities of color. And we have to keep fighting on all of those fronts. And one of the things that it's important to look at the gendered and racialized dimensions of disasters and disaster responses because these mm-hmm. things really do have a multiplicative effect. And mm-hmm. so if someone is subjected to more violence because of the stress that goes up in the hurricane, but then they also have fears of turning to officialdom for help because of all of the well-founded fears of mm-hmm. not getting the help they need. And then on top of that, there's a police presence that enters the community with the idea of controlling bad actors as opposed to assisting victims. It's, mm-hmm. it's a really hard nut to crack.
It's, I think, you know, we're sort of talking about sexual violence in a very top-down way right now. So I think it's really important to remind ourselves where this is anyway. So you mentioned before before I turned the recorder on once again, that one of the tensions, and I've talked to other people about this in sort of post-disaster work, also is a tension between being an organization that does political organizing and doing sort of service provision and how, you know, the struggles with trying to figure out what is the best use of your limited time and resources and energy. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that and how you've been grappling with that as an organization.
Well, we've been like many other people, we've gone back and forth about what makes something organizing versus servicing. And it's not necessarily the nature of the work, right? It's more the, mm-hmm. I think, the approach to the work, like how one carries out the work. Because in the wake of a disaster, people need a lot of services. And they just need a lot of very practical help. And it might be giving out water, and it might be helping with disaster unemployment applications, and it might be many other things. And so what we have started to think about is that it's important to be able to respond to some of the needs, the immediate needs in the community with actual, with actual services that are helpful. And we want to partner with different groups that have different expertises that can do that. But it's also important to try to inject, political education into the delivery of services. So we want to make sure that when people get information and they go to a legal clinic, like when they came to our disaster relief legal clinics, that in addition to getting information about FEMA applications and disaster unemployment applications and disaster food stamp applications, that they get time to talk, mm-hmm. that we have time to talk with them about their rights on the job and what to do if there's a problem and they face a threat, or what to do if they're not paid, or whether they anticipate any problems with access to health care and where they go go for healthcare so that we can try to make sure that they have, that the healthcare centers are open and that they have the ability to get all the services they need and they know about the sorts of programs for reduced fees for access to healthcare. Anyway, so we try to set up these services, yeah. these clinics, so they go from one station to another station and they get the services that they need. And then they go to a station that's really a political education station where we talk about what is needed to make sure that people have their rights and how they can access and express their rights, but also what's needed to make the changes that will make this better. We saw tremendous problems with the way the state delivered its or allowed applications to be processed for both the disaster SNAP and the disaster unemployment work, and that mm-hmm. those programs are only for families who are eligible and document being here legally or being a citizen or part of those eligibility requirements. But because those programs were administered in such a bad way, not only are the people who are eligible negatively affected, but the other people who may or may not be documented who could have benefited mm-hmm. by this infusion of resources into low-income communities were affected. And we have to sort of – we talk to people about how do we make sure that the state extends these programs and does better next time around, because – one thing that is certain is that there's going to be another hurricane. Like, we know these are happening every year, and we have to yeah. do a better job of demanding that that the state is prepared to provide the services that exist and not mm-hmm. place obstacles in the way of people accessing these services. Yeah. The other thing we really want to do is use the canvassing that we do in the neighborhoods to assess needs mm-hmm. as a way to also educate people about the community groups that exist and get more people involved and talk to people about policies. We might not do all of that in one conversation, but we want to sort of every single conversational opportunity we have with individuals in our community, we want there to be both a short-term and a long-term impact. And a short-term impact might be the information about immediate needs, but the longer-term impact has to be information about making voices heard by acting collectively together. And that means mm-hmm. that we have to start when we start training people to do canvassing for any purpose 6 months earlier or a year earlier or, 9 months earlier, we have to train them in canvassing methods that are more conversational, less checklisty, mm-hmm. deeper kinds of information sharing, deeper kinds of deeper canvassing methods, because these have to be meaningful conversations. Every contact has to be both practically useful and also politically meaningful.
What's the most important thing for people who are not at the moment, anyway, in a place that has been hit by one of these disasters, to know, and what can people do if they want to be supportive to the communities that are trying to recover?
I really think one of the things that is most important is to, I guess I would say to get rid of this sort of simple division between the notion of services and organizing and start thinking mm-hmm. about how to inject everything we do with a dose of broader vision or creative conversation making. So I think we have to think about how do we inject and build pathways for communities to have a voice in decision making in creative ways every single day. Like every single day, how do we support that? And how do we have, how do we create, relationships so that folks who are not in an area that's currently being hit by a disaster are also hearing from the people who are affected and hearing in ways that are, I don't know exactly how to say this. I mean, there's a tendency to just say everything sucks or everything's great and nothing in yeah. between, right? And it's an in-between space. There are people, yes, there are people who are doing amazing, wonderful, helpful things, but there are systemic problems. How do we get to the systems that are making these disasters not only have this short-term impact that's really hard, but how are we making sure that we're putting in place the monitoring to make sure that a hurricane doesn't spawn privatization of the schools a year down the road, but also how mm-hmm. are we putting in place the kinds of connections so that people can talk about why, so that voices can be lifted up in ways that are a little more complex and a little more thoughtful and a little bit more about trying to see the relationship of, for example, retaliation or threats of retaliation to access mm-hmm. to food, to access to decent housing. These, the interplay of anti-immigrant policies and actions with day-to-day needs is very, it's complicated, but it's super important. If people are not, if we aren't focusing at every single moment on sort of the organizing rights or the right to have a voice and the right to be free from retaliation for lifting your voice, as well as the substantive need, then we're going to lose, we're going to keep losing ground even if we deliver and answer need. So I guess you're asking me this question is helping me figure this out. That's, I guess, what I think the core is. That people who are not in a place currently being hit by a disaster should think about the need that others are focusing, but also should help keep, driving an agenda that makes it possible for those who are in a disaster zone to lift up their voices and complain or reach out for services without facing repression and retaliation. Those organizing rights, access rights, information rights, whatever you want to call them, protest rights, those, mm-hmm. the ways those rights can be eroded that's something that's really scary.
Yeah, absolutely. How can people keep up with you and with the Miami Worker Center?
Well, we're on Facebook and we have websites. The Miami Worker Center is, I think it's just called Miami Worker Center on Facebook, and that's probably the mm-hmm. best way to keep up with what we're doing. And then Advocacy Partners, which is the legal counterpart, is under Advocacy Partners team on Facebook too. So we're both communicating with posts and with articles and things like that.
Interviews for Resistance is a project of Sarah Jaffe with assistance from Laura Fayebois and support from the Nation Institute. You can find more information at necessarytrouble.org. Thanks for listening.